The Catra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Catra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling, well, a huge subject, Islam. It's globally significant, obviously, but often gets boiled down to headlines, doesn't it?
It really does. And there's so much nuance that gets lost. So we're trying to, you know, cut through some of that noise today.
Exactly. And our guide for this is a fantastic little book. Well, short, but dense with insight. Malise Ruthven's Islam. A very short introduction.
Yeah, it's really quite a feat, packing so much complex information into an accessible format. Really rigorous, but readable.
So our goal here for you listening is pretty straightforward, but we think quite important. We want to step back from the day-to-day political commentary and give you a more balanced framework, analytical, nonpartisan.
Right. So when you hear about events in the Muslim world, you'll have a better sense of the kind of deeper historical and intellectual currents at play.
Because if you're only getting Islam through, say, geopolitical news flashes, you're missing this vast civilizational picture.
Absolutely. We want to show it not just as, you know, a personal faith, but as this whole system, civilization, really. It's this complex tapestry defined by, well, both unity and a lot of internal diversity.
And getting that context is just crucial, we think, for understanding its role today, politically and socially.
Okay,
so maybe let's talk about the author first. Malise Ruthven. His background seems really key to why this book works so well.
Definitely. He's Irish-Scottish, an academic, a writer.
Yeah.
His whole focus has been on Islam, the Middle East, and importantly, religious fundamentalism.
And he's got this interesting mix of experience, right? He's taught at universities, Aberdeen, UC San Diego. So he has that deep academic grounding.
Mm-hmm. But then he also worked for the BBC World Service, mm-hmm. wrote for places like The Economist. So he can communicate complex ideas really clearly. He bridges that gap between like pure academia and journalism.
And I think what really stands out, what makes his viewpoint distinctive, is that he comes at it primarily from political science and history, not theology first.
Precisely, yeah. And that lets him look at Islam as this historical and social force, almost like a program for action in the world, you know?
Yeah.
How people have tried to live this faith out over, what, 1,400 years?
Right. So it's that combination of the scholarly depth, but with that journalistic clarity that makes it, well, so useful for someone just trying to get a handle on the basics.
Yeah. And you see his focus on these modern interactions in these other big books, too, like A Satanic Affair or Fundamentalism, The Search for Meaning. He's been wrestling with these questions for a long time.
So turning to the book itself, the core argument right off the bat kind of challenges that typical Western idea of separating, you know, religion and public life.
Totally. Ruthven basically says, look, you can't grasp Islam if you only think of it as a personal belief system, like just private spirituality.
He argues it's fundamentally this comprehensive thing, social, legal, political, all rooted in this idea of a divine law, the Sharia. The religion itself is meant as a blueprint for society.
Yeah, a blueprint. I like that. So the history of Islam then becomes this ongoing story, often messy, sure, but always dynamic, of trying to apply the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad's example to totally different times and places. It's about shaping the world according to that blueprint.
And the book isn't just a straight history lesson, is it? It's structured thematically.
Right. It doesn't just go chronologically.
Yeah.
He starts with the foundations, the Prophet, the Quran, then moves straight to what he sees as the core element, that divine law, the Sharia.
Okay.
Then he explores the internal complexities, like the Sunni-Shia split, mysticism like Sufism.
Mm-hmm.
And wraps up with this huge encounter with Western modernity, colonialism, and all that.
So it's really designed to give you, the listener, a full picture, analytical, nuanced, and hopefully, yeah, cutting through some of the partisan noise we usually hear.
Now, before we get into the real nitty-gritty, it's worth mentioning how he sets it up in chapter one. He stresses right away, Islam isn't monolithic. The ideal might be unity, the ummah, but the reality, always diverse.
But the thread holding it together is the central role of the Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly. Chapter 2 really digs into this. Muhammad isn't just presented as a spiritual guide. He's like the complete package. State builder, lawmaker, military leader. He forged a unified community out of tribes.
And that complete role is why, even today, politics and spirituality are so tangled up in many interpretations. It's baked in from the start.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got the Quran, believed by Muslims to be the literal, uncreated word of God. But here's the key insight Ruthven gives us.
Yeah.
While it's the ultimate source, it's not like a legal textbook you can just flip open and apply.
Right. It's revelation, not a statute book. It needs interpretation.
Exactly. It's profound, but it demands this huge amount of intellectual effort to figure out how it applies to real life. And that need for interpretation, that's what leads us directly to the Sharia, which is maybe the most misunderstood concept of all.
Okay, so Sharia, chapter 3. Ruthven calls it the core of the faith.
Yeah, the core. It's meant to be the practical expression of God's will, guiding, well, everything. Personal piety, family life, business, justice, the whole spectrum.
But the headlines just scream, Sharia law. Like it's the single brutal code. How does Ruthven get past that stereotype?
He clarifies that Sharia is the ideal, the divine path, the human effort to understand and apply that path. That's called fiqh jurisprudence. And that process, the human interpretation, is this dynamic methodology. It's not static.
Okay. So Sharia is the goal. Fiqh is how humans try to get there.
Pretty much. And this fiqh methodology is built on four main roots, the usul al-fiqh.
Which are the Quran itself, obviously. Then the sunnah, that's the prophet's example, his sayings and actions recorded in hadith. Then ijma, scholarly consensus. And finally, qiyas, using analogy or reason to apply existing rules to new situations.
Right. And because it relies on these sources and human reasoning, it allowed Islam to adapt as it spread across the globe. It wasn't rigid. This led to the different major schools of law, the madhahib.
So the madhahib are like different ways of reading the same constitution, all valid within the same legal tradition.
That's a great analogy, actually, yeah. They all accept the Sharia ideal, but they have slightly different methods for interpreting the sources to arrive at fiqh.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, shifting from law to internal divisions, the big one, Sunni and Shia, Ruthven tackles this in chapter 4. He says it didn't start with theology, right? It was political.
Exactly. It kicked off with a crisis right after Muhammad died. Who should lead the community?
The Sunnis, who are the vast majority, now felt the leader, the caliph, should be chosen based on merit and consensus from the community.
Mm-hmm. While the Shias believed leadership was divinely ordained, belonging only to the Prophet's family line, specifically Ali, his cousin and son-in-law, and the Imams descended from him.
It's fascinating how that initial political disagreement becomes so deeply ingrained emotionally and theologically. Ruthven points to the martyrdom of Ali's son Hussein at Karbala.
Yeah, Karbala is absolutely central to Shia identity. It really cements how that political split evolved into these profound, enduring theological differences. It's about justice, suffering, legitimate authority.
And speaking of different paths within Islam, chapter 5 shifts again, this time to the inner dimension. Sufism.
Right, the mystical path. Yeah. Sufism is all about the inner spiritual state, seeking direct experiential knowledge of God, cleaning the heart, so to speak. It's often seen as a kind of balance or corrective to the outward focus on law and ritual in the Sharia.
Asking why we follow the rules, not just what the rules are.
Exactly. And a really key figure here who stopped Sufism from just being a marginal thing was the great theologian Al-Ghazali.
Ah.
He managed to brilliantly integrate Sufi spirituality into mainstream Sunni thought. He argued that, yeah, you need the outer observance of the law, the Sharia, but it's empty without that inner sincerity, that spiritual depth that Sufism cultivates. You need both.
Which brings us, maybe inevitably, to the modern era, chapter 6, the modern crisis. Ruthven really frames the encounter with the West, especially colonialism, as this massive existential shock to the traditional Islamic world.
Huge shock, yeah. For centuries, Islamic civilization had been dominant, or at least on par. Suddenly, it's confronted by these technologically and militarily superior Western powers. It forces a deep reckoning.
And Ruthven outlines three main ways Muslim societies responded, which still shape things today. They were all grappling with that same core question. How do we live? How do we govern ourselves in this new Western-dominated world?
Right. The first response he identifies is secularism, basically adopting Western political and social models, pushing Islam into the private sphere. Kemalist Turkey is the classic example.
Okay. Then the second.
That's modernist reform. Thinkers like Muhammad Abdu in Egypt. They argued that true Islam is compatible with reason, with science. They called for a reopening of ijtihad, that intellectual effort of interpretation to adapt Islamic principles to modern life. Not abandoning Islam, but reinterpreting it.
And the third response.
Islamism, or what's often called fundamentalism. This path rejected both secularism and compromise. It argued the weakness came from abandoning pure Islam. The solution, a return to the sources and the establishment of an Islamic state governed solely by Sharia. Thinkers like Seyyed Qutb, movements like the Muslim Brotherhood fall into this category.
So the key takeaway here for anyone listening is that contemporary political Islamism isn't just some ancient relic resurfacing.
Not at all. It's a thoroughly modern ideology. It uses the language and symbols of tradition, yes, but it's born directly out of that modern clash with Western power and ideas. It's a response to modernity.
That's a really crucial distinction. Okay, so pulling back a bit, if we look at the whole book, what are the big overarching themes Ruth Finn keeps hitting?
Well, the first one, you just can't escape it, is the centrality of law, this idea of nomocracy ruled by divine law. Because Islam aims to be that societal blueprint, Sharia touches everything, which explains why modern debates about, say, banking or women's rights become so heated. They're not just social issues, they touch the very foundation of faith's public role.
Yeah, that makes sense. What else?
A second major theme is this constant push and pull between the ideal of unity and the reality of diversity. The concept of the unified global Muslim community, the Ummah, is incredibly powerful. But the historical reality, fragmentation, sectarian splits, geographical differences, cultural variations, that tension itself drives a lot of history and politics.
It's like the blueprint versus the actual building process on different terrains.
Exactly. And related to that is the third thing, this dynamic interplay of revelation and interpretation. The Quran is considered fixed divine revelation, but applying it, that requires constant human intellectual effort, Etihad. Islam isn't static. It's this ongoing 1400-year conversation between the text and changing realities.
And the final big theme you mentioned is how Islam's encounter with modernity became this defining crisis.
Right. Pretty much every major political trend in the Muslim world today, secularism, modernism, Islamism, can be understood as a different answer to that fundamental question posed by the rise of the West. How should we relate to this new global order dominated by non-Islamic powers and ideas?
Okay. Those are really helpful frames. Now, Ruthven has some lines that really crystallize these big ideas. We pulled out a few that kind of stuck with us.
Yeah, he is good at summing things up. Mm. The first one really nails that core thesis about the nature of Islam itself. Paraphrasing slightly, it's like, more than just personal faith, Islam is a divine blueprint for society, and the Sharia is its architectural plan.
That really shifts the perspective, doesn't it? Away from just individual belief.
Mm-hmm. Then there's one on the Sunni-Shia split that clarifies the origin. The split began as a political argument over leadership, but it bled into theology. Hmm. It grounds this huge historical division in something initially very human, very political.
Before it became, you know, centuries of distinct traditions.
Exactly. And the third one is so important for understanding today's world, cutting through stereotypes. Modern Islamism isn't a return to the past. It's a thoroughly modern ideology using traditional language and symbols to tackle contemporary problems.
So it's not medieval, it's modern, just using a different toolkit in a way.
Precisely. It's an ideology of response forged in the modern era.
So thinking about how this applies, what are the practical takeaways? How does understanding Ruthven's points help us in real life?
Well, the most immediate thing is it helps you move beyond seeing Islam as one single thing. Understanding the internal divides, Sunni-Shia, the different legal schools, the mystical versus legalistic approaches lets you analyze global events with much more sophistication.
Like it suddenly makes sense why, say, Shia Iran and a radical Sunni group like ISIS would be absolutely mortal enemies, right? They both claim Islam, but they represent completely different historical paths and visions for its future. They're fighting over that blueprint.
Exactly. And for anyone working in like international business, policy, journalism, this kind of framework is invaluable. It's an antidote to sensationalism. You hear Sharia law in the news.
Yeah.
And instead of just reacting to the soundbite, you understand, okay, this is shorthand for a complex legal tradition with diverse interpretations over centuries. It fosters a much more balanced view.
And just on a personal level, maybe if you're interacting with Muslim friends, colleagues, communities.
Yeah, understanding the cultural weight of things like community, family, the role of divine law in shaping values, even if individuals practice differently, it just provides crucial context for, you know, respectful and meaningful engagement. You understand where certain perspectives might be coming from.
So wrapping things up, what was the most maybe surprising or valuable thing you personally took away from revisiting this book?
For me, it's always that emphasis on the sheer intellectual dynamism,
yeah,
the ijtihad. This idea that for centuries, enormous mental energy went into interpreting and applying the core texts. It just completely blows up the notion of Islam as inherently static or resistant to change. It's been a living, evolving conversation.
Yeah, I agree. That really struck me too. And for me, perhaps it was a reinforcement that the internal pluralism, the sects, the schools of law, the cultural variations isn't some kind of failure or deviation from the norm. It is the norm. It's a core feature of the tradition's history. Rifkin gives you the tools to see the unity and the diversity at the same time without contradiction.
Well put. It holds both in tension.
So it leaves us with quite a bit to think about.
It does. And maybe final thought for you, the listener, to chew on, building on Rothman's framework. If Islam, particularly through the Sharia, is conceived as this blueprint for a God-centered community, how truly successful can any modern secular nation-state model be in the long run if it tries to completely sideline or marginalize that foundational concept within a Muslim-majority society? That tension, that negotiation, that seems to be the central, unresolved debate still playing out across the Muslim world today.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.